Session 80, August 24, 1964, The Early Sessions, Volume 2. Good evening, Rob. Good evening, Seth. Jane smiled broadly. Seth, I was indeed giving you a much-needed vacation, but I could feel you clamoring about this evening, and so we will visit for a short time. Rupert's encounter with his father in many ways did him good and was largely advantageous. The encounter had nothing to do with his cold and with yours. The abandon of your dancing was good for both of you. The indisposition, or cold, came about for a strange reason, based mainly upon the symbolism placed by both of you upon the establishment in which you created the fragments last year. It became, oddly enough, a place of psychic hominess. Rupert, in particular, resented the material changes made there, and felt left out in the cold. Jane smiled again. Seth, there is more to it than this, but this is the basic reason. The added expectation of cold weather helped. You will find a spilling over often, where attitudes and expectations show themselves in various mediums. You picked up his cold for the same reason. Actually, you expected subconsciously to catch it, and should now be overcoming it. Rob notes, the irony here being that I had been making efforts, consciously at least, to convince myself that I would not catch Jane's cold after she developed it last Tuesday. I came down with it, actually, on the evening of Saturday, August 22, while Jane and I were sitting in a drafty bar with her father in Saratoga Springs, New York, while on our way home. It was a cold and rainy evening. Seth, I am not going to hold a full session by any means, simply because a vacation is definitely advantageous. However, I did not want to fail to arrive when I felt that you expected me. I would suggest that you read a good portion of the material in the meantime. I may say a few short words Wednesday. However, a regular session will await the following Monday. The unpleasantness for this date was avoided largely because of your own improved expectations and understanding. I will now wish you a fond good evening. You may, if you wish, conduct small experiments together without me. And now, good evening. Rob, good evening, Seth. Session 81, August 26, 1964. Early Sessions, Volume 2. Good evening. Rob, good evening, Seth. Seth, I have said that I will speak but briefly. I will mention, however, two incidents in which the two of you showed success in the psychic manipulation of the world of matter. One instance concerns Rupert and your automobile. The other involves you, Joseph, and again, your automobile. I am insistent that Rupert have a vacation, at least to some degree, and will not go deeply into these matters until our next session. There is much to be explained. Needless to say, emotional impetus was at the base of success at both occasions. The lack of emotional impetus was the main reason for your failure when the both of you tried to move the ring, using your psychic energies the other evening. Rob notes, here Seth surprised us by referring to one of our little efforts of last Monday evening after the session. In this experiment, we sat at a bare table in the dimly lit room. On the table lay Jane's ring, an inch from the ashtray. Our objective was to focus our psychic energies together and move the ring until it struck or touched the ashtray. From various information Seth had given us, I believe such things are possible at times, and Jane agrees. This time, however, Jane quickly became impatient for some reason and literally commanded the ring, mentally, to move. Of course, it did not. Seth, these simple remarks will themselves be the basis for further, rather involved discussions, as the mechanisms that are set into motion in such mental or psychic manipulation of matter have never really been explained. Remember, however, that such psychic manipulation of matter is the normal occurrence. It is, however, usually operating at subconscious levels and without either knowledge or intent as far as the conscious mind is concerned. To be able to bring these natural but subconscious forces at all under any domination by the conscious mind is a terrific task. Such domination will never be habitual, but conscious awareness of subconscious manipulation of matter may become habitual, and may often, of its own accord, follow the desires of the conscious mind, if certain conditions are met. First of all, the conscious desires must be in league with and unopposed by subconscious expectations. Two sufficient emotional impetus must be discharged, and this will be on or from subconscious levels. And three, communication between the conscious and subconscious, or the inner and so-called outer parts of the whole self, must be excellent. Conscious desire to achieve a given end may represent only a superficial, culturally adopted wish that may even be directly opposed to the emotionally charged desires and expectations of the inner self. If this is the case, then the seemingly desired end is not really either desired or expected, and the subsequent manipulation of matter will fall short of success. When Rupert heard from you that the servicemen seemed not to know what was the matter with the car, she instantly remembered what I had said about expectation. Consciously, he decided to expect that the car would be fixed, despite your truly gloomy semi-predictions. Because his conscious desire was based strongly upon inner emotional need and not opposed to it, and because the emotional need at that time was powerful, that is, his need to leave on vacation, and because he remembered our discussion on expectation, he was able to utilize both conscious and unconscious energies, in other words, to consciously focus his subconscious psychic abilities to perform toward a definite material end. Now here, this end, seemingly, to his mind, could be achieved in no other more ordinary way. Whether the end could have been achieved in another way makes no difference. Emotionally, he did not think or believe that it could be. This added to the strength with which he focused his abilities, and I will have more to say concerning this attitude, which often, but not always, accompanies such psychic manipulations, even ordinary ones of which you are not aware. Rob notes, the car incident discussed by Seth refers to one I had forgotten already, although at the time it affected me strongly, and as I look back upon it, I recall it was the main reason for our experiment with the car's oil consumption. It took place on Friday afternoon. We were due to leave on vacation Saturday morning. As a precaution, I took the car to our regular gas station and left it for an oil change. This was at 1 p.m. I was due to pick it up at 5, then meet Jane at the gallery to drive her home. Walking down to the garage at the appointed time, I saw the car still up on the lift. The assistant mechanic told me there was something wrong with the filter cap and that it could not be tightened sufficiently to prevent an oil leak. His boss was busy and asked me to stop back later. After we'd had a chance to look at the car, of course, I realized how Jane would feel if we could not leave on vacation in the morning, should the car not be ready. Watching the assistant as he struggled to tighten the cap, I had the distinct feeling he didn't know too well what he was doing, and that the amount of force he was using could strip the threads and really delay the trip if a new part had to be found, then replaced. It meant dismantling part of the steering mechanism. Making my feelings plain, I thought, without saying much actually, I left the garage and walked down to tell Jane, who by now had left the gallery and was waiting for me outside. I had time during the walk to give some thought to using positive expectation, but had not calmed down enough to try it effectively. Jane immediately announced that the car would be ready when we went back for it, and asked me not to think about it while we went out for supper. We ate quietly and slowly, then walked back up to the garage. While two blocks away, I thought I could see a blue and white car parked outside it. Jane said it was our car, though I was sure she could not see it, actually well enough to know for sure. But it was our car, ready for us. Jane told me then that all through the meal she had concentrated as hard as she could on the fact that the car would be fixed and waiting for us. She was, she said, determined to go on vacation Saturday morning. Seth. Included in further discussions will be some of the reasons why the presence of the other individuals may help in the psychic manipulation of matter, though I will not go into this evening. I will also cover your achievement, as when you actually increased your car's efficiency on your return trip, it was somewhat different, though basically the same as Rupert's achievement. And I will also explain why Rupert did not conquer his cold psychically, although he tried. Rupert's voice did suffer not at all from our sessions, although I know that he has been coughing and hacking all day. Perhaps the session will even give it a rest. I would continue the session, except that Rupert has more or less been promised a 2-week vacation, and he has not even had that as far as I am concerned. I think I will let you rest, and I may not decide to continue. Rob notes Seth's confirmation that I had at least some success with my car experiment prompted me to suggest to Jane that when we drove to Rochester to visit my brother, William Richard Butts, that we should both concentrate on keeping the car's consumption of oil to a minimum. The distance, perhaps 120 miles each way, would be long enough for an accurate measurement to be made coming and going. Seth. Prayer has been extremely successful in enabling individuals to manipulate matter through use of their psychic abilities. The God concept, however, is true and not true. Myths and symbols are often closer to reality than what we call hard facts, since so-called hard facts are often distortions of the outer senses. These distortions, however, are necessary frameworks for existence of the inner self in the material universe. Again, then, even the hard facts are true and not true. An open mind, therefore, or an open spirit, must be large enough to contain within it room for what may seem to be utterly opposing data. Myths and symbols often are closer to reality, again, than so-called hard facts. This is true, but so-called hard facts that may seem opposed to symbols and myths are not necessarily untrue, since they may be necessary distortions without which the inner self could not survive in the material universe. I have decided to tackle this to some degree here and now. The myth of God, as given in Christian theology, is too clearly seen by the intelligent adolescent to have evolved and changed from the Old Testament to the New Testament. The mature adolescent, even in his mental and emotional framework, knows that no one male deity, no one super individual, exists in some well-insulated heaven where he yet is personally concerned with the most intimate affairs of man, mice, mosquito, and sparrow. For one thing, the adolescent is turning aside from the domination of both mother and father. For another thing, this is space age for you. Is heaven or Mars or Venus? How many stars will man explore before this archaic heaven be found? To the intelligent, even the symbolism of the crucifixion is abhorrent. Does this mean, however, that such a crucifixion did not occur? It may not have occurred in one place and in one time and to one called Christ, but because man has created the myth, he created the crucifixion out of his own need, and this crucifixion, which historically did not occur, as the myth says it occurred, nevertheless has as much reality and more than it would have had it occurred in so-called hard fact. So the intelligent adult now knows, does he not, that no one individual but superior being exists as God in some heaven, threatening hell to the sinners and disbelievers. For many reasons, the idea does not make logical sense. You never emotionally believed it. Rupert did. So the hard fact would seem to be that there is no God. there would seem to be a point of departure. Either you believe in the myth, or you believe what would seem to be hard fact. I suggest your break. The hard fact, to intelligent minds, must be that there is no God. The myth insists that a God exists, and the intelligent man finds himself in a dilemma that does not exist for the unintelligent. This is merely coincidence. The fact is that the myth comes closer to reality than the fact. The myth represents man's psychic attempt to understand facts that he must distort in his existence on the material plane. He must distort them simply because existence on the material plane necessitates a way of focusing his abilities that will not allow the larger scope of focus to operate. This focus, which I have mentioned before, has been chosen by him to meet the circumstances of his existence. Now, prayer once enabled the intelligent man to focus his psychic abilities because the hard fact, taken for granted by all in Western civilization, was the belief in such a God. The so-called hard fact has changed. The truth behind the myth still exists. Mankind has been engrossed in dreams of a God who is like himself, except that he was considered to be superior and possessed the highest qualities that man admires in himself. The God myth enabled him, man, to give his higher so-called instincts an objectivity, and the God concept represented and still represents a link with the inner self. Now, as far as hard facts are concerned, there is no God as mankind has envisioned him, and yet God once existed as mankind now envisions him. What he is now is not what the religious think he is. Yet once, he was only what they think he is now. For in fact, he did evolve and was not complete, but represented a supreme will to be from the beginning. He is not human in your terms, though he passed through human stages. And here the Buddhist myth comes closest to approximating reality. He is not one individual in your terms, but a psychic gestalt, an energy gestalt. If you will remember what I have said about the way in which the universe expands, that has nothing to do with space, then you will perhaps perceive, though dimly, the existence of a psychic pyramid of interrelated, ever-expanding consciousness that creates simultaneously and instantaneously universes and individuals that are given through the gifts of personal perspectives, duration, intelligence, psychic comprehension, and eternal validity. It is this that your God concept hints at. Now, the absolute, ever-expanding, instantaneous psychic gestalt, which you may call God if you prefer, is so secure in its existence now that it can constantly break itself down and rebuild itself. Its energy is so unbelievable that it does indeed form all universes, and because its energy is within and behind all universes and all planes and all fields, it is indeed aware of each sparrow that falls, for it is each sparrow that falls. This does not deny the free will of man, which is indeed misinterpreted. That supreme energy does indeed fight for existence in whatever form it shows itself, and justice, for your information, is only a human term, short-sighted at best. You would both do well to remember this. I suggest your break. Continuing, I am not going to keep you much longer, nor have I any intentions of starting a new religion. I am, however, trying to tell you the truth, and this material is perhaps the most important of any so far, in that comprehension of it will allow the intelligent man to avail himself of energies and abilities once utilized in prayer. Prayer is now shunned. Why prayer if there is no one to listen? The prayer contains within it its own answer. And if there is no white-haired, kind old Father God to hear, then there is instead the initial and ever-expanding energy that forms everything that is, and of which every human being is a part. This psychic gestalt may sound to you impersonal, but since its energy forms your person, how can it be? If you prefer to call this supreme and absolute psychic gestalt God, then you must not attempt to objectify him in terms of material, for he is the nuclei of your cells, and more intimate than your breath. I know this much and no more. He is not human. He is not he, if you are thinking in terms of sex, nor is he she. Such separations and designations are merely arbitrary in your field. He is the individual in the term that many energies are focused into one, and indeed there is one infinite personality, but it is a gestalt. There is, then, truly no beginning or end, because we are speaking in terms of expansion that has nothing to do with space or time, an evolution in dimensions of which you and your kind have not yet even dreamed. As an idea expands, changing a world but taking up no space, and unperceived by your scientific instruments, so does the ultimate and instantaneous absolute gestalt, which you may, if you prefer, call God, exist and expand. There are those who will say that such a concept represents an escape from reality. These men, however, follow their outer senses slavishly. They ignore and fear the inner reality and the inner ideas and dreams which have actually formed the reality of which they are so proud. It is true that undisciplined, hysteric flight into such realms can be dangerous, at least in the short run. But disciplined, balanced, curious, and open-minded pursuit will lead to self-fulfillment, betterment of the race in general, and will be the means for releasing innate, inhibited energy toward constructive ends. I will at another time go into the crucifixion myth and its strong element of truth. Since you, Joseph, seem slightly restive, I will close the session. You have learned much, and this material will stand many in good stead. Rob, good night, Seth.